We are Vineyard.
Somos Viña.
We are Vineyard.
Well, you know, I wasn't a missionary kid for very long. It was like 4 years. Some people grow overseas their entire life. But right. Even though it was a short amount of time, it had a deep impact on me because of the trauma that I experienced, mm-hmm. But also the people that I experienced and the life in the church. And so I think, you know, one of the vivid scenes that happened on the morning of August 2nd, when the troops invaded our house, multiple sets of Iraqi troops invaded our house in the middle of like the bombing campaign to take over Kuwait City. It was the fourth largest army in the world, Iraq was then. And there was troops that were harassing my mom in my room, and I was really scared they were gonna take her, and we were gonna be separated. And I just started crying at 10 years old. I mean, I was just crying powerless. Like, these guys got AK-47s, and I just remember praying like very vividly, God, if you get me out of this, I will serve you the rest of my life. Like, wow. I'm here for you. And so, so that's like probably like the trauma of my childhood. I came back, had nightmares, didn't want to be left alone at 12 years old, 13 years old in my house, went to counseling, processed a lot of that. But I think that one of the ways that God has used that in my life is that I wake up every day, and every day since then, being like, every day is a gift. Like, you have a sense of urgency. Like, I could have not been alive today. And there's a lot of kids that don't make it out of war-torn areas.
Welcome to the We Are Vineyard podcast, conversations to help us grow with Jesus and each other. This season, we have a number of incredible guests lined up for you, and we're excited to let you know that this season's episodes will also be available as videos. So subscribe on YouTube and never miss an episode. On today's episode, Jay talks with Aaron Graham, who's an author and the founder and lead pastor of the District Church, a thriving multicultural congregation in Washington, D.C. Let's listen in.
Well, Aaron, thanks for joining me.
What's up, Bishop? Yeah. Bishop Pathak, thanks for having me on.
You just do that to torture me. That's why you do that.
I love it. I just want to remind you of your role.
No. So where are you sitting right now? You're in your office?
I am in my office in our ministry center in Washington, D.C. It's an old Catholic convent, so a nun used to live in this room. Wow. We took a vow of poverty, chastity, and obedience to serve the Lord, and now I get to serve the Lord. We have 21 room, 11 bathroom convent that we converted to our office space.
Wow. And she never imagined you being there doing this, I'm sure.
Probably not.
But here you are. And we've known each other a decent amount of time, actually. I was thinking about it as I was praying for you this morning, this time. I thought, It's funny how, you know, you just enter into relationships and you have no idea where they're going to end up. But you're doing incredible stuff. So I'd love to just hear a bit of your story to start. So tell me about where you were born and where you grew up. Let's just start there.
Yeah, born in Memphis, Tennessee. My dad was a pastor, missionary, and he started the chaplaincy at St. Jude's Children's Research Hospital. So I just come from a great family of faith and heritage. My parents, when I was 6 years old, felt called to be missionaries in Liberia. So we moved to West Africa and lived there for 3 years, and that was elementary school. So that was hugely formative in my life, just learning to be cross-cultural and learn how the church is alive internationally and other places, global church. Civil war broke out there, brutal civil war, Charles Taylor, and it was, you know, so many people were killed. We left before it got too bad. We lost all of our stuff, so we just kind of got out with our book bags and suitcases.
Wow.
And then my parents were feeling like, we're still called to be missionaries, but we need to go somewhere that also speaks English. And they ended up feeling called to this tiny little country in the Middle East called Kuwait. And nobody had really heard of Kuwait at the time. It was 1990. And we showed up and we moved there in May of 1990. And then August 2nd of 1990, Saddam Hussein invaded with the Iraqi troops. And we were caught up in that whole ordeal. So my mom, my brother, and I were held a hostage for 6 weeks, and my dad for 3 more months, and he was miraculously released. So 10 years old, I lost my stuff twice, both times in 2 countries, and ended up coming back and settling in Richmond, Virginia, which is where I went to middle school, high school, and college in Richmond.
Okay, so you had only been in Kuwait
like 4 months.
4 months before everything hits.
3 months before everything hits, and then another month. Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. And how did they discern Kuwait? How does that happen? I mean, that's not like Liberia to Kuwait isn't exactly like a natural.
Yeah. A couple things. One is that my dad has a learning disability. So him learning languages is very difficult. So in Liberia was formed by freed slaves. So Liberia speaks English. There's tribal languages and villages, but that's the primary language. And then in Kuwait, it's of course Arabic, but most every sign in Kuwait is also in English. So there was that part. And we were Southern Baptist missionaries, and there had never been, a Southern Baptist missionary there. So it was kind of in the 1040 window, you know, unreached area, predominantly Muslim country. And there was this small little piece of land right in downtown Kuwait City where a missionary, Miss Scudder, had was a doctor, a missionary doctor, and she had delivered, I think, the Shaw at the Times, like, baby. And as a gift, he said, I want to give you this plot of land, small plot of land, where anybody can freely worship. So in a predominantly Muslim country, to have a place where you can freely worship. And so it became an international place of worship where people 7 days a week are coming in and out, having worship, a lot of immigrants in Kuwait. And so my dad pastored the English-speaking service. So it was a Presbyterian before him, and then he was stepping in to lead the English-speaking service. So we were planning to be there for until I graduated from high school. But Saddam Hussein had other plans.
Yeah, I would say.
Yeah.
So that's 6 to 10. From between Liberia and Kuwait.
When I was internationally, yep.
Wow. And so as a kid, did you see yourself as a part of this mission? I mean, were you like, yeah, we've decided to do this? Or are you just like, I don't know, I'm just, where do I put my toys? What am I? I mean, you know what I'm saying? Like, there's different ways of understanding like your identity.
So my parents just moved into a retirement community. So I was going through all these old letters, like letters that they wrote back home. This is pre-email, like in the 80s, the missionary support letter every month. Mm. And there were so many letters in there that, you know, give an update on me and my brother Peter at the end. And they would just talk about how I longed to go with my dad to the villages. And I would just love doing ministry with them. Wow. And so I really adapted well. And I remember kissing the walls of our house in Liberia when we met and praying that I would be able to return one day. And so I felt like it wasn't something, a decision they just made for me, and I was just along for the ride. I think the beginnings of my calling to ministry began both in Liberia and Kuwait, and God was planting that seed of cross-cultural ministry among the poor, the seeds of that, you know, in the midst of war and all that began to be planted.
Wow. That's, I mean, listen, it's your story, so you're used to it.
Yeah.
But I assume that every time you tell some version of that, people are like, what? Like,
yeah,
that's not that common of a story, obviously, even for MKs.
Yeah.
And a lot of MKs, which is a missionary kid, I've heard many stories where people go through horrible things like you're describing, and it blows their faith apart. It blows the faith apart of the parents, and if not the parents, then definitely the kids.
Yeah.
Here you are as a pastor now, so I'm going to assume you weathered that somehow.
By God's grace.
Yeah. So How do you understand that?
Yeah.
When people go through things that are not quite as insane. I mean, like the core questions come up, like, well, Lord, why would you have us there for 2 months to be held hostage? Why?
Yeah.
What is this?
Yeah.
I mean, how do you understand your story as distinct from some of those? And of course, the right answer is God has been kind to me. But outside of that, I mean, in what way is that kindness worked its way out with your folks and with you?
Yeah.
How do you make sense of that?
Well, you know, I wasn't a missionary kid for very long. It was like 4 years. Some people grow overseas their entire life. But right. even though it was a short amount of time, it had a deep impact on me because of the trauma that I experienced, mm-hmm. But also the people that I experienced and the life in the church. And yeah, so I think, you know, one of the vivid scenes that happened on the morning of August 2nd, when the troops invaded our house, multiple sets of Iraqi troops invaded our house in the middle of like the bombing campaign to take over Kuwait City. It was the fourth largest army in the world, Iraq was then. And there was troops that were harassing my mom in my room, and I was really scared they were going to take her, and we were going to be separated. And I just started crying at 10 years old. I mean, I was just crying powerless. Like, these guys got AK-47s, and I just remember praying like very vividly, God, if you get me out of this, I will serve you the rest of my life. Like, wow. I'm here for you. And so, so that's like probably like the trauma of my childhood. I came back, had nightmares, didn't want to be left alone at 12 years old, 13 years old in my house, went to counseling, processed a lot of that. But I think that one of the ways that God has used that in my life is that I wake up every day, and every day since then, being like, every day is a gift. Like, you have a sense of urgency. Mm. Like, I could have not been alive today. And there's a lot of kids that don't make it out of war-torn areas. We happen to have, you know, the United States and a coalition of 60 countries that, like, once Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait, got aircraft carriers and sent 500,000 troops to Saudi Arabia. So I had their help, you know, to basically get us out. And like a lot of kids in war-torn countries don't. And so the thing I think I wrestle with, one of the questions is like, can you see the suffering of the world and still love it? Like, still love the world, still love the people of the world. And I think that trauma and suffering can cause people to like isolate and be removed and to close down and be like, this is too much, and go into depression and withdraw.
Yeah.
Or it can cause you to like be super engaged and like, I got to make my life count. So for me, it's like, it's the engaged side. And so now I have to make sure I don't try to do too much. I don't try to overdo it. That I'm like, hey, I'm one person. So.
Yeah. Yeah. You can't change everything at once. Yeah. That's right. Yeah. Okay. Okay. So now you're back. You obviously have some sense of a call to ministry. Like, I think I'm doing this. You're growing up in Richmond, Virginia. Is that what you said?
Richmond, Virginia, the suburbs, suburban culture shock. Yeah.
Wow. I was going to say, that's also an interesting, like, that's very different than where you were before that. Okay. And so you start to pretty early on feel like, I have a call to ministry. I think this is what I'm called to do.
Yeah, but I wouldn't have expressed it at that age as a call to ministry. You know, I got to Richmond, went to 6th, 7th, 8th, 9th grade. My dream was to make the NBA. I played basketball all the time. I started a lawn care business. I was making money. And it wasn't that I was like drifting from God. God wasn't the center. It was
right.
girls, popularity, and all that. And when I was a sophomore in high school, my dad was the associate senior pastor at this large church, and he was kind of also the mission pastor. And we had an opportunity to go to Belize when I was 15 years old on a mission trip. He wanted to take me. And I was starting on my JV basketball team, and I would have to miss 2 weeks of the season, including two games. And I told my coach that I wanted to go on this trip. And he said, you can go, but you'll lose your starting position. Mm. And like for a 10th grader, like I had to really pray about that. I was like, I really prayed about it. And I felt like, no, I'm supposed to go on this trip. And when I was on the trip, I remember this sacred encounter I had, where there was a elderly woman that was on the streets outside of the motel we were staying, who was begging. And I was in like Spanish 2 or 3 at the time, so I knew enough to kind of understand that she was hungry and wanted something. So I go up to my room, find like a trail mix and banana, and take it back down to her and speak a little bit of Spanish, pray for her, and discover that she has AIDS. And she was the first person I met, this is 1995, that had AIDS, so that was new for me. But I just had this like very simple time of ministry at 15 years old. And I literally walked away from that encounter just being like, God, I'm going to serve you the rest of my life. Like, I can't imagine doing anything different. I've never imagined being a pastor speaking in front of people, but I just felt like being a missionary in some way was like the core of my calling. And I came back, still played basketball, still played some sports, but that was now secondary. And I became like the leader in our youth group and really began to devote myself to ministry, think about where I go to college based on ministry calling. But I never thought it would be pastoring a church. I just saw most churches in the U.S. as dead. Like I hadn't really seen an alive church that was diverse, that was meeting real needs. I just hadn't been exposed to that. It was much more cultural Christianity. So that the international experiences I had as a kid really shaped me.
That's really good. That's really, really good. Yeah. I mean, there is, as you know, a live debate on like what is short-term missions.
Yeah. The value of it. Does it do more harm than good?
It's not helpful, and it's, you know, poverty tourism or whatever. And I understand all those arguments, and they're probably very substantial and real. But for me, much like your description, I think short-term experiences like that exist almost solely for the people going. I mean, if you could just change the orientation, like, we're not helping anybody.
Yeah, here. It's a discipleship show.
Exactly, totally. Yeah. We are being immersed so that we understand who we are in the world story and what it means to be a part of the church. And so if you can shift that, then all of a sudden those are really useful,
totally
powerful experiences. And if you contribute anything at all, even one time, what a gift, but probably won't.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's
totally. And I think partners want two-way relationships where we're coming, we're receiving from them knowledge, faith, ministry. Yeah. And yeah, we might be sending dollars because we live in the richest country in human history and our churches have more, you know, we don't feel like we have more money than we can do, but we just have more resources than most churches throughout the world. And so we have a responsibility to share that and steward it well and to pray for and be in solidarity. But the exchange, the two-way exchange is incredible. And now so many churches have people from the nations in our churches. And so there's natural relationships that are not just formalized by big NGO, mission agent, parachurch ministries, but they're happening on the lines of relationships, which is exciting.
Totally. Okay. So there you are, 15, being like, okay, this is what I'm doing. You didn't make the NBA, turns out. So
Not yet. I've still got a chance, man. Come on.
Is there... I told you, I think the last time I saw you, I told you I was playing in an over 40 league, which by the way, is the way to do it. Yeah. Like you're suddenly fast again, you're quick, you're good all of a sudden again. It's amazing. So I would recommend it for your own ego. So if they make an over 40 NBA team, you might have another qualify for that.
Yeah. Let's go.
So you graduate, and then are you thinking, oh, yeah, I'm going to go to Bible school, I'm going to get more training, or are you like, I'm going
to... Yeah, I was ready to do ministry. I was planning to go to Eastern University. My mom worked at the University of Richmond, so I had tuition exchange, so I could go to a lot of other schools. But I applied to University of Richmond, where she worked, and I got in. I didn't think I was going to get in. It's pretty competitive academically, and I got in. And so I ended up going in town, but lived on campus, and... University of Richmond was started as a Christian school, but it's not anymore. And I really got a great education there, but got to see and experience some incredible moves of God while I was there. And so I appreciated actually not being in a Christian bubble there. It helped me begin to integrate my faith with culture more.
Huh. Okay. So then what was your degree in?
Leadership studies. So they started the first undergraduate program in leadership where you can major in leadership, Jepson School of Leadership Studies. And so that was my major. It's basically very interdisciplinary, applied to leadership. And because I was called to ministry, like I did my thesis on visionary church leadership. And I was able to do a lot of my papers around ministry, which was great. I minored in sociology and did a bunch of religion classes that I thought I was going to go get trained for ministry in religion classes, but that was not the case.
They tried to train you out of it. Yeah.
Totally. It was like historical Jesus, feeding the 5,000 didn't really happen. I was like, whoa, I'm like, I wasn't prepared.
Yeah, totally. Okay. So then you're walking, you've been a part of some cool stuff. You're seeing, you have all this leadership training. What's the first jump then? What's the first move?
Yeah. So my freshman year going to, you try to pick a campus ministry. They're all kind of small, 20, 30 people. Show up at Fellowship of Christian Athletes one night because some folks invite me. You know, like, oh, I'm not playing a sport. But like, no, come on. Pastor Don Coleman, inner city pastor, grew up in foster care in Richmond, Virginia, is preaching. And I come in late to the room and I'm sitting on the front and he's like preaching. He's like, what are you going to do with your life? You know, he's just like, and I'm like, I'm going to serve the Lord, you know? And so he was discipling Stuart Royal, who was leading FCA. Mm. And they ended up discipling me, these two inner city Pentecostal pastors. I grew up Southern Baptist. Wow. Father, Son, Holy Bible. Like, I didn't know about the Holy Spirit other than the Holy Spirit leads you into relationship with Christ,
right,
and helps you identify what your spiritual gift is. But then you're kind of left to yourself. Like, I was kind of—
might convict you of sin. That's another thing you might do.
Yeah, might convict you of sin. But it's like, it's, there's nothing about the manifestation gifts at all.
Totally.
So I learned prayer through them because they prayed every morning for an hour at their church and after school program. And they challenged us to pray and they challenged me to pray. Cause I began to take on leadership in FCA cause I was the only one that, like, all the athletes are too busy to lead it. So like student leaders actually needs to not be an athlete.
Right.
And so started leading FCA and we ended up starting prayer in the chapel at the university across different ministries for an hour every morning, Monday through Friday. We said no for like 6 months. They were challenging us. And we're like, we're busy college. Nobody could get up that early.
Yeah.
And we began to pray and we began to see God do incredible things. We began to pray for our lost friends. And FCA grew to, we started having 100, 150 people at our Sunday night gatherings. InterVarsity grew from like 30 to like 100. And probably 10 people went into ministry out of that. We ended up doing an evangelistic event for this school of 2,800 people that over 1,000 people came to. Mm. Some people were radically saved there. One guy on the football team, he used to be known for drinking a case of beer every Friday night. And he would do cartwheels in the dining hall the next day because he was so hungover and drunk. And he came to Christ. He's like now an elder in his church, like, and, you know, 20, 25 years later. So we just saw God do incredible things. And I was like, I got a taste of prayer, inner city ministry, revival at the University of Richmond. So it was great, great experience and foundation. So even though I wasn't pastoring a church, I was literally doing ministry probably 10 to 20 hours a week while I was getting my degree. So it was good training.
What an incredible experience. Okay. So then you're coming out of that. And you're like, all right, I think I should do what job? What do you, because I know when I first come in contact with you and I'm trying to figure out how to draw the line to what you were doing. What I meant, so how do you end up with Jim Wallace and doing whatever? What draws the line there?
So before I came to DC, I went to Boston for 5 years. So my former youth minister was planting a church in Boston. I helped him between my junior and senior year as a summer intern plant a church for young professionals in downtown Boston.
Wow.
While I was there, I was coordinating summer mission teams that were like supporting the church. And so I was spending time in the inner city, like helping coordinate these volunteers. And through that, I was like, I am called to go serve in the inner city of Boston. So I literally, Matthew 10 style, where Jesus sends out his disciples and says, take nothing with you and go find a person of peace. I literally gave everything I had away, put everything in a book bag, got a one-way ticket to Boston, and I was ready to sleep on the streets of Boston. And I had met a few people there. And one of them was a woman named Mossis, who was like the matriarch of Boston. She's like the Mother Teresa of Boston, matriarch of the community. And she had an abandoned auto repair shop that she turned into a thrift store. And she really ended up taking me in and had a vision to start a Bible study. And so she asked me to lead it. It unintentionally turned into a church. I met Amy at the same time. She was a campus minister. Mm. We ended up getting married. We do urban ministry for 5 years. I pastor. So at 22 years old, I'm a white boy pastoring an all-black church in the inner city of Boston. I'm like, what business do I have doing this? So it was crazy. And the way I summarize that is I never did a wedding in 5 years there, but I did probably like 7 or 8 funerals, and like 4 or 5 of them were for youth connected to our youth group or connected to our youth group who were killed on the streets. So it was my school of ministry. That was an intense time. I ended up starting some seminary work, went to grad school, studied public policy. And I just began to feel like, you know, I always thought like politics and business, I was like, I'm not going to major in that undergrad because people in politics just care about power and people that study business just care about money. And then I went and lived in the inner city, and I realized, wow, politics and business have a lot to do with how our cities are organized and what people are dealing with. And I'm trying to disciple people and get them jobs and housing. And you're a social worker and a pastor when you're in that context.
Totally.
And so I just began to understand and learn about systemic injustice.
Yeah.
And Dr. John Perkins had a big influence on me. I just was at his funeral, passed away at 95 years old. And he really talked about living in the community with people, relocating, working towards racial reconciliation. And then I read an old book by Jim Wallis called Faith Works. Mm-hmm. And it was just all about like how the church needs to be on the ground level in the community. It was the beginning of the faith-based initiative that former President Bush put together. And so ended up getting connected with him. And he had just written his next book after God's Politics called The Great Awakening, around how kind of Billy Graham meets Dr. King. And what if there was these justice revivals that were happening in cities throughout the U.S. that would pull together like a evangelistic, call people to Christ, and then mobilize them to address an issue of poverty.
Yeah.
And so I was like, Jim, I'm not very like sojourners-y. Like I'm definitely not as progressive theologically, but like that vision, sign me up. Like, and so came and worked for him for 3 years. We moved to DC and I did that for 3 years. And that's how I began getting connected with the Vineyard community.
Man, that's hard. So that must have been really hard to leave Boston though, with that amount of investment.
Yeah. 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 Totally. It's easy for your identity to get wrapped up in like, I'm the urban minister. I was just hanging out with Shane Claiborne last weekend. We were having dinner. He wrote Irresistible Revolution. And we used to write letters to each other because we were so convicted, like we're not going to have cell phones. And we would write letters to each other. I still have letters. And he was living radically among the poor in Philly. And I was doing it in Boston.
Yeah.
And, but I kind of got to this point where I'm like, I'm pastoring a church of 30 people. It really needs to be an indigenous local leader. Like I kind of fell into this. And so we ended up ordaining Moses's son, who had gotten out of jail, who had a radical conversion in jail, and doing that. And I just realized, like, no, God's giving me leadership gifts that are broader than just this. And so how do I use that?
Yeah.
And but it was really formative to me, and it humbled me, taught me servant leadership, taught me to not be in it for the name, for the brand, for the recognition, for the scale, but like, you know, loving people at a personal level when nobody else notices. It was my first 5 years of ministry.
Well, and what I find amazing about your story, which is true of almost anyone I know that works in the kind of context you were in, is the sort of dichotomy between ministry, church ministry, and community organizing. It just doesn't exist. It's like what it means to pastor and care for people in this context means we're thinking about how schools and businesses run in this place and what it means to interact with government programs. These things aren't like separate streams where they can be if you're in a more suburban, less urban context. You're like, oh, yeah, we should probably think about how we could partner with so-and-so to help with whatever. Yeah, we should probably do that. Let's get somebody over there in that meeting. When you're doing what you're doing, it's like, no, this is like the same thing. Like if we're going to be helping the humans in our world.
Yeah.
And the learning curve of just like trying to get inside of people's lives. Like, so wait a minute, why am I doing another funeral? Like what is the story here? And how are people getting involved in this? And that is such an education, such a steep learning curve and such a clear call that you're just like, I'm just going to show up and do this.
Yeah. Yeah. And I was discipled by a lot of Black inner city pastors who they don't compartmentalize their faith in their life because they can't. Like when you're experiencing injustice or poverty, like you have to connect it all. And I think that I grew up in some context where it could be more, faith could be more compartmentalized. And if you had one bad decision, then you kind of get a therapist over here and you treat it and you try to not have it disrupt the rest of your life. But like if you're poor in the inner city and something goes south, like everything goes south. And so then you have to rebuild it. And so that really taught me to live like an integrated view of discipleship. And I was just really learned a lot through that.
Wow. Okay. So you're going to do justice revivals with sojourners. And then that's when I think you bump into the Vineyard because you're in Columbus, right? Is when you're building the organization stuff. So talk about how then you, because I know your story of how you kind of bumped then back toward, maybe I should be a pastor again, like in DC. Yeah.
So I was in charge of Justice Revivals, and one of the possible places to do that was for Vineyard Columbus to host it, because Rich Nathan was so evangelistic, but also had just opened the community center and was just caring for so many like Somali refugees and like was Ted Strickland was the governor. It was like he just entered like, you know, the both and church, like you can hold all this together. And so this was like my first meeting ever with a mega church pastor. So, you know, you go into this big building, big office, walk through, you know, a couple offices and assistants to get to the back. And I sit down, and Craig Hesselton and Rich were in the meeting. It was me. And like, no lie, like 5 minutes into the meeting, I'm like getting in, you're trying to like ask them, would you host this Justice Revival? And like 5 minutes into the meeting, Rich just like, in the true Rich Nathan fashion, just looks at me and he says, Aaron, at some point, you're going to have to make the decision whether you're going to be a political organizer or whether you're going to be a pastor. And he said, when God shows you that, just give me a call, because I want to support you and get behind what you're doing.
Wow.
And so I filed that in my head. And then 3 years later, when God did call Amy and I to intentionally plant a church, Boston was an unintentional church plant, but to intentionally plant a church, he was one of the first calls I made. And him and Marlene had me and Amy out to their house, and they just mentored us. And Rich has just been a huge champion of helping me be a church planner, had a lot of coaching calls throughout, you know. I just remember I was trying to make it so complicated, being like this missional orientation. I remember him saying, Aaron, you're like opening a donut shop and like you're just serving glazed donuts. Just serve like the Sunday service. Just serve like the best glazed donut in town. Get some momentum to be able to do all the other things, but don't make it too complex up front.
Totally.
And so he had a big influence. And that's how I learned. I mean, first meeting, I know your name came up because you had planted Mile High Vineyard and in a similar context, and everybody's saying, you know, you got to meet Jay Pathick. You got to meet Jay Pathick. You let Joshua House and doing all this stuff. So that's when our connection started.
Everyone gets to play naturally supernatural, the main in the plane. If you're a Vineyard person, you've been hearing phrases like this for a long time. Some of you have said them from stage. But if someone stopped you in a parking lot and asked you what one of them actually meant, you might need a second. That's not a memory problem. That's just what happens to a movement's language over time. It becomes shorthand. It's how we talk to one another. But you need these phrases not just to be memorable, but to hold weight, to carry meaning and story for you. Heart of the Vineyard is an 8-part video resource to help you with this. It's a series of short talks and conversations with people who know and love the Vineyard and want to help you and your church get stronger. It's coming this fall to vineyardusa.org/grow. Have you ever wished there was a way to help the girls in your church grow in their faith while connecting to generations of women? That's the vision behind Vessels. Vessels is a place for girls in grades 3-6 where faith, fun, and biblical truth come together. More like a club than a classroom, it combines engaging Bible teaching, crafts, jewelry, music, and authentic relationships that help girls discover their God-given value, purpose, and identity. At the same time, Vessels creates opportunities for women and girls to build meaningful relationships across generations, strengthening both along the way. Now, my daughters have absolutely loved being a part of Vessels. I've been so impressed by the depth of what they're learning each week. It's helping them build a strong foundation following Jesus, memorizing scriptures, and discovering who God called them to be. Now is the perfect time to explore bringing a club to your church. The Vessels team will be at several regionals this fall, and they'd love to meet you there. Or visit godsvessels.com to learn more and schedule a conversation. That's godsvessels.com. The next generation won't be discipled by accident. Let's be intentional. Do you ever feel just scattered? Whether you're an established church or just starting out, Planning Center helps you connect every ministry and sync every detail. From volunteer schedules and kids check-ins to donations and event signups, then you can feel at ease knowing things are in their right place. Get started for free today at planningcenter.com. The We Are Vineyard podcast is a production from the team at Vineyard USA. If you've been enjoying the podcast, leave us a review on YouTube or the podcast platform of your choice. Connect with us online for additional resources. Our website is vineyardusa.org, and we're on Instagram and Facebook at Vineyard USA. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week.